The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Welcome to Discover Extra Edition. Stories from Discover, the magazine of science, that we didn't have time for in our regular monthly podcast. I'm your host, Steve Lord, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Episode number 6 of Discover Extra Edition contains 6 stories from the November and December 2017 issues of Discover, covering The Scent of a Lover, Color, Diagnosing a Rash, Pluto and Ceres, The New Horizons Space Probe, and Bears. Scent of a Lover. Inhaling body odor can offer more information about people than their emotional state. The health and biological compatibility of the opposite sex might also be gleaned, all the better to help pick the perfect mate. In an experiment published in 2014 in the journal Psychological Science, people could tell who showed signs of sickness by their body odor. The researchers injected the sweat donors with a toxin that prompted an immune reaction. From an evolutionary standpoint, smelling sickness or disease has advantages. Choosing an unhealthy partner is not the best way to pass on your genes. Yet, of even greater gene-spreading significance is the ability to tell differences in MHC, the major histocompatibility complex, a gene family linked to the immune system and body scent. Scientists have long known that animals such as mice and rats can tell how genetically related they are to others of their species by smelling one another's urine. Studies show humans are masters of this skill, too, and thankfully no urine smelling is necessary. When scientists from the University of Chicago asked a group of women to sniff T-shirts worn for 2 consecutive nights by different men, the women pinpointed their closest genetic matches, even though there could be millions of unique combinations of MHC genotypes. A study by researchers from McGill University in Canada involving neuroimaging, which creates pictures of the brain's structure and neural activity, showed that smelling the body odor of someone closely related activates the dorsomedial prefrontal cortex, a part of the brain responsible for recognizing family. Biologically, it makes sense. We want to protect our own gene pool, Lundstrom says. But it's not so much picking the best partner, it's deselecting bad partners. Research shows that people, and women in particular, prefer potential partners who are somewhat genetically related, but not too related. Having children with someone with an MHC genotype that is too similar, studies show, can lead to spontaneous abortion or low birth weight. Conversely, pursuing someone with a close or semi-close genetic makeup means preserving adaptations to an environment. Think regional people having immunity to local strains of pathogens. Meanwhile, some scents can make us appear more attractive to potential partners. Take the aroma of grapefruit. In a study that involved guessing the age of women shown in photos, participants knocked off 12 years from actual ages if they smelled and enjoyed the smell of grapefruit. If the participants smelled spicy and floral notes, the women appeared 4 pounds slimmer. And it's much safer to buy cologne for people within your family rather than outside it. Genetic kinship seems to influence smell preference. In one study, people with similar genotypes chose similar perfume ingredients. 20 things you didn't know about color. 1. For centuries, academics thought colored light was modified white, or pure light. We'll get back to how wrong they were in a bit. 2. And color sometimes is a modifier. For example, coloring foods goes back at least 3,500 years, when ancient Egyptians added wine and other colorants to candy to increase its visual appeal. 3. The history of coloring food is stained with nefarious deeds. Toxic lead and mercury-based compounds were once pervasive in Asia and Europe to add color to tea and cayenne and curry powders. 4. In the mid-18th century, Americans were so used to yellow milk tinted with lead chromate to disguise the bluishness of watered-down dairy that people refused to purchase white milk, thinking it had been colored. 5. They weren't entirely wrong. In the 1660s, Isaac Newton demonstrated white light is anything but pure. It's composed of all colors of light combined. 6. Scientists refer to color in terms of wavelength, a characteristic of electromagnetic radiation, but there is no universal match of specific wavelength values to specific color names. Encyclopedia Britannica, for example, defines blue light as having a wavelength of 450 nanometers, but the average person might call anything between 425 nanometers and 490 nanometers blue. 7. And that's just in English. Other languages, including many tribal African tongues, describe green and blue as different shades of the same color. 8. In Russian, light and dark blue are distinct colors rather than different shades of the same color. 9. Regardless of language, our biology is the same. Human eyes have evolved trichromatic vision. We only see red, green, and blue. Full perception happens in the brain. If your eyes see lots of red and green but not much blue, your brain decides you're seeing yellow. 10. Any color where the amount of red, green, and blue appear equal will seem gray to humans. 11. This, of course, assumes color vision. Red-green color blindness occurs when red or green color receptors are missing or mutated, primarily in people with XY chromosomes. 12. In XX chromosome individuals, however, the same mutated color receptors may provide what's called four-color vision. Though researchers disagree on tetrachromacy's characteristics and prevalence. 13. In 2010, 62 years after the first suggestion of human tetrachromacy, a study identified a woman with distinctly enhanced vision. She was picked for the test because two of her three sons had reduced sensitivity to green, suggesting she had the mutation. 14. No matter how many we can see, all colors result from interaction between light and electrons. Figuring out what type of interaction is responsible for each color can be a challenge, however, since there are 15 different mechanisms. 15. Cobalt pigment, for example, makes the rare gemstone blue spinel a deeply saturated blue, while the Maxike's type beryl gem may appear dark blue after exposure to radiation. 16. And wings of the Morpho butterfly appear as different shades of blue, or even violet, depending on how the light hits them. This effect is typical with light-scattering structures like the tiny scales that cover the insect's wings. 17. In 2015, researchers found that the wings of the dragonfly Xenithoptera lanii, though similar in appearance to Morpho wings, get their color from waxy crystals that cover layers of the pigment melanin. 18. This effect, called structural color, has also been found in chameleons that can tune nanocrystals in their skin to change color the way tuning a guitar changes its pitch, as reported in 2015 in Nature Communications. The lizards tune up for camouflage, as well as mating displays and possibly thermal regulation. 19. Color can also change during chemical reactions. When the hemoglobin in red blood cells loses oxygen, it takes on a bluish tint. But blue blood is a myth. Blood flowing through our bodies is dark red due to a mix of hemoglobin with different levels of oxygen. 20. Dark green blood can be a thing, however. In a non-fatal 2005 case, a Canadian man's blood turned green after he took too much migraine medication. Sulfur atoms had started to bind with his hemoglobin, a process that would typically only occur in putrefying corpses. Sorry to wrap things up on a dead note. Hope I didn't give you the blues. More than skin deep. When multiple specialists can't solve the mystery of a toddler's persistent rashes, Grandma offhandedly offers a clue. The toddler wriggled across the exam table, laughing as he crinkled its paper covering. His grandmother, Joanne, scooped him onto her lap, rubbing his back as he sucked his thumb. She lifted his hospital gown and unfastened his diaper, showing us the raw skin beneath. Teary-eyed, she told me and another pediatrician the story of his rash. About a year earlier, Joanne had received full custody of 2-year-old Calvin when his parents, struggling with drug addiction, could no longer adequately care for him. The child seemed healthy, just hard-headed and prone to tantrums, Joanne said. Though tight on money, the grandmother was determined to be a good surrogate parent. 3 months after Joanne received custody, scaly red patches appeared on Calvin's groin. A primary care doctor prescribed an antifungal ointment. For a month, Joanne lathered it on with every diaper change, but the rash got redder and rawer. She returned to the doctor, who advised a stronger antifungal cream and a topical antibiotic. But there was no relief, and the rash spread to Calvin's face, inner thighs, and lower back. He scratched constantly, crying himself to sleep each night. Desperate, Joanne brought him to a hospital emergency room where he was given oral antibiotics and a referral to a dermatologist. That doctor diagnosed eczema and prescribed steroid ointments, both ineffective. Still, Joanne hoped the prescribed moisturizing regime would work. She rubbed thick coats of Vaseline on Calvin, then squeezed him into wet pajamas with another layer of dry pajamas on top. The symptoms remained. A visit to another dermatologist resulted in prescriptions for stronger steroids and other antibiotics and moisturizers. But none worked. Calvin then went through a bout of watery diarrhea. That's when Joanne brought Calvin to my pediatric team. The rash was terrible. His buttocks, thighs, groin, and mouth area were bright red and raw, the skin dry and flaky in some places, wet in others. His skin was the worst I'd ever seen. Calvin had other symptoms. His hair was thin and patchy. His eyebrows and eyelashes were thin, his lips cracked, his tongue bright red, and his gums bloody. His belly protruded, and his legs were swollen up to the shins. Joanne said these conditions had appeared in the last few months. "What does he eat, generally?" I asked. She rolled her eyes and sighed. "He is so picky," she said. "It's a struggle. Since he moved in with me, I can't get him to eat anything. All he'll take is teething biscuits and chamomile tea, and he likes it a little sweet. Drinks 3 bottles a day." One of my colleagues recognized Calvin's symptoms from her years abroad caring for children in areas with famine. Calvin was starving. Tests showed that Calvin's body lacked several key nutrients. One was zinc. People with zinc deficiency can have rashes resistant to topical treatment. The mineral, found in many foods, meat, seafood, beans, nuts, grains, is essential to good health. A key cofactor for dozens of enzymes, zinc helps the body heal wounds, synthesize DNA, divide cells, make proteins, and operate the immune system. Our bodies are unable to store it, so we must eat it daily. Other symptoms of zinc deficiency are changes in hair texture, profuse diarrhea, and stunted growth. Meanwhile, Calvin's lack of protein had swollen his abdomen and legs, a particular type of malnutrition called kwashiorkor. Lack of vitamin C had caused his gums to bleed. Vitamin B12 deficiency had cracked his lips and reddened his tongue. Blood tests revealed immature and irregularly shaped red blood cells, deprived of iron and vitamin B9 or folate. X-rays showed bones bowed and fraying from growing without enough vitamin D. Calvin needed to eat, but carefully. After long starvation, the body can be overwhelmed by nutrition, triggering a dangerous condition called refeeding syndrome. In changing from a state of fasting to eating, secretion of insulin and synthesis of fats and proteins can disturb levels of phosphate, magnesium, and potassium. The heart requires normal levels of these electrolytes to keep pumping and beating normally. Too much food, too fast, can actually kill. We admitted Calvin to the hospital for observation and treated him with targeted vitamin supplementation and a healthful diet. Though Calvin's grin was charming, his mealtime hospital behavior was less so. He fought food, pushing it away, then flinging it wildly and splotching the walls with pureed carrot, globs of banana, and sticky pasta. He refused food with specific textures, colors, and temperatures. It was clear that he had developed mental delays that made it difficult for anyone to feed him. His grandmother was overwhelmed and lacked proper health services support for a child with special needs. We enlisted a feeding therapist and child life specialists who brought discipline and creative ways to make meals appealing. For example, food was made in various shapes and colors and served with sauces and dips. They helped Calvin explore new foods and taught Joanne how to establish an engaging mealtime routine. Over weeks, with his grandma's help, Calvin became a voracious eater. Thanks to vitamin supplements and feeding therapy, his rash disappeared in a week. His bones strengthened. His weight increased steadily. His energy skyrocketed. We soon had trouble containing him. He preferred skipping down the hospital halls and playing hide-and-seek at the nurse's station. Why did Calvin's problems take so long to diagnose? Perhaps because his doctors were so specialized, they didn't step back to ask what else might be going on with him. The boy also had relatively few follow-up exams, making it difficult to probe for other causes of his condition. After his release from the hospital, Calvin began seeing a pediatrician who got to know him. He also was diagnosed with developmental delays in his learning, language, and motor skills, probably related to in utero substance exposure and the unstable household he lived in during his first year. The issues were mostly resolved through improved diet and behavioral therapy. The boy's life went from painful rashes and food tantrums to a full belly and professional support for his challenges. Grandma's house became a much sweeter home. Separated at birth. Despite their enormous differences, Pluto and Ceres might actually be long-lost twins. Ceres and Pluto don't seem to have much in common. Nestled in the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter, Ceres is a tiny loner, while Pluto, in the Kuiper belt at the edge of the solar system, is nearly three times as big and hosts a handful of moons. A mixture of rock and water ice dominates Ceres' landscape, while methane and nitrogen ices cover Pluto. A thin, hazy atmosphere hangs over Pluto, while atmospheres have seen only faint traces of gas above Ceres. The worlds are so dissimilar that planetary scientist Steve Desch says he is one of only a handful of researchers familiar with both. But look a little closer, and it turns out the dwarf planets aren't all that different. New traces of ammonia on Ceres hint at a much closer relationship between the pair. Large depressions mar the surface of each, and both feature icy volcanoes, possibly powered by liquid beneath the surface. In fact, astronomers are beginning to consider them twins, albeit fraternal, born in the same place at the same time, but separated almost immediately after birth. Their differing adult features reflect their adopted environments. One more commonality. NASA spacecraft visited both worlds in 2015. New Horizons flew past Pluto, and Dawn began orbiting Ceres. It's thanks to those missions that we have all this new data in the first place. If you took a Pluto-like body and put it in the asteroid belt, it would probably look a lot like Ceres, says astronomer Will Grundy, a co-investigator for New Horizons. It turns out that might actually be the case, with Ceres originally starting out nearer to Pluto, before getting shoved around by the bigger planets. The early solar system was a chaotic place, and astronomers now suspect many of the planets may have wandered before settling into today's orbits. Two models, both devised in the 2000s, best fit the orbital data. One, the Grand Tack hypothesis, suggests that Jupiter and Saturn initially ducked inward to the inner solar system before gravitational imbalances sent them back to their current orbits far from the Sun. The other, the NICE model, suggests the four gas giants, Jupiter through Neptune, initially had tiny, tight orbits, which eventually spread out slowly to what we see today. The two theories aren't mutually exclusive. Sean Raymond, one of the theorists behind the Grand Tack, says it was designed to work with the NICE model. They play well together, he says. In all the early chaos, 1,000 Plutos may have formed in the distant part of the solar system where Neptune orbits today, including a nascent Ceres. Then the shifting gas giants scattered those bodies everywhere. In the great rearrangement of the solar system, Pluto went outward, Ceres came inward, says planetary scientist and New Horizons co-investigator William McKinnon. He proposed Ceres migration in 2008, the first hint of a potential sibling relationship between the two worlds. It's possible that Ceres could have formed near its current place in the asteroid belt, McKinnon concedes, but then it would be a most unusual asteroid. The dwarf planet alone accounts for about a third of the belt's mass, and its icy interior distinguishes it from its rockier neighbors. Plus, recent observations of Ceres' surface of ammonia, of household cleaner fame, also hint toward a more distant origin, to a time and place when such compounds were more common. As for Pluto's migration, Neptune probably managed the heavy lifting. When the ice giant spiraled outward, it carried nearby smaller icy bodies along with it, shepherding them toward the edge of the solar system. It's just a twist of fate that Neptune carried away Pluto, while Jupiter and Saturn brought in Ceres. The dwarf planets defied expectations when NASA's spacecraft arrived. Instead of observing cold, dead blocks of ice, Dawn and New Horizons saw dynamic planets with signs of ongoing activity. Although water and ice should evaporate rapidly on Ceres with its exposed surface, Dawn saw signs of ice in some of its craters. Pluto, far from the Sun, constantly repaints its surface with new material, most likely liquids welling up from below and freezing on its surface. Both worlds might also boast the same strange phenomenon, icy volcanoes spouting frigid lava. Ceres only has one mountain, a dome-like bulge about half the size of Mount Everest, known as Ahuna Mons. Pluto has a pair of slopes in its southern hemisphere, informally named Wright and Picard Monts. On Ceres, the ice is made up of frozen salt water and mud, but on Pluto, it's probably ammonia. While we think of ammonia like Mr. Clean and Windex, very liquid, McKinnon says, at Pluto's sub-freezing surface temperatures, ammonia freezes into solid ice. Once you get it that cold, it's like honey or hot basaltic lava, so it will act more like lava, he explains. Desch and Mark Nouveau, both at Arizona State University, model cryovolcanism on icy worlds. Nouveau says a slushy mix would be driven to the surface of both planets, if the fluid has an extra push. What could provide that push? Two potential scenarios. Gas seeping from the liquid solution, like carbon dioxide escaping from an open soda can, and a pressure difference caused by the slow freezing of liquids. Both worlds actually show signs, recent signs, of such oozing eruptions. On Ceres, the relatively smooth flanks of Ahuna Mons and the presence of water ice suggest material bursting forth from within. The strange texture of the plains around Pluto's mountains suggests flowing lava. Scientists aren't sure yet how active the volcanoes are today. If Pluto and Ceres are so similar, why do they seem so different? Location, location, location. Pluto spends its time far from the sun, where temperatures hover around minus 391 degrees Fahrenheit. Ceres is much closer and can heat up to minus 37 degrees Fahrenheit, warmer than summers at Antarctica's Vostok station. On Ceres, you could wrap up and walk around with a bunch of jackets. And oxygen, says New Horizons planetary scientist Carrie Leese. On Pluto, you couldn't do that. You would have to add a heavy double or triple layer inside your spacesuit. This fundamental difference in temperature accounts for many of the current disparities between the two worlds. The most vulnerable substances, such as the methane and nitrogen ices found on Pluto, would have quickly boiled away on Ceres' warmer surface. In fact, when Dawn spied a muddy crust on the tiny dwarf planet's surface, scientists suspected it may be the dregs left behind when the original outermost layer was stripped away, exposing a once liquid ocean beneath. Ceres could have been about half of Pluto's size, planetary scientist Julie Castillo-Rodriguez says. Closer initial sizes certainly make the worlds more likely to be related. And while Ceres' ocean has frozen, Pluto's looks like it has a subsurface ocean that froze fairly recently, or might even be still liquid today, another of New Horizons' shocks. This leads to a practical benefit. It's currently impossible to probe beneath the icy crust of a planet like Pluto. But if Ceres does have an exposed frozen, once subsurface, ocean, that gives planetary scientists a useful proxy. Beyond the temperature disparities, the two worlds' neighbors also contribute to their differences. They were both bombarded in the chaotic early solar system. But Ceres would have been the target of rockier bodies that did more damage than Pluto's icier associates. One enormous impact formed Pluto's photogenic heart, a basin 1,100 miles wide known as Tombaugh Regio. Methane ice crept up from Pluto's subsurface ocean to fill the crater. Since older regions are more heavily cratered, a lack of craters suggests the area is no more than 100 million years old. That's an eye blink in the 4.5 billion year lifetime of the solar system. Ceres' massive basins were harder to spot. Astronomers thought the dwarf planet should sport multiple giant impact craters, but the Dawn probe didn't see any. Simone Marshy, a planetary scientist at the Southwest Research Institute in Colorado, did find traces of large impact basins comparable to Tombaugh Regio in Dawn's data. The strongest contender is a 500-mile-wide depression known as Vendimia Planitia, which probably formed when a large object crashed into Ceres. Unlike what happened on Pluto, any ice that filled up the basin on Ceres' warmer surface would have quickly turned to gas from the sun's heat. While planetary scientists have some potential answers, they've barely scratched the surface of the data from New Horizons and Dawn. New Horizons sent home its final observations of Pluto last year, and Dawn is still orbiting Ceres. As they ponder new data, we'll learn even more about the planets and how closely related they just might be. It's like being a mechanic trying to fix a race car and a pickup truck, Desch says. They're alike enough to learn something about one from the other, but different enough to be a lot of work. But then, whoever said unraveling the mysteries of the solar system would be easy? The next horizon. 4 billion miles away, an ancient and pristine world awaits. On a desolate coastline in Patagonia, astronomer Alan Stern huddles behind a semi-trailer to block his telescope from the wind. It's not long after midnight on July 17th, the peak of southern winter, and 40-mile-per-hour gusts howl across the landscape. Stern, who heads NASA's Pluto-visiting New Horizons mission, is one of 56 scientists with 24 small telescopes spread for 30 miles along Argentina's Atlantic coast. Some evade the telescope-shaking wind behind 15-foot-tall steel-framed tarps, built with supplies raided from local hardware stores. A few find shelter in natural alcoves on the beach. The conditions were generally miserable for observing, Stern says, but above, the heavens were crystal clear. Their celestial quarry? The roughly 14-mile-wide shadow of a world 4 billion miles away, one just discovered a few years earlier. When this ancient object passes in front of a background star, the star's light dips, like a mini eclipse, allowing the astronomers to tease out the mystery world's size, shape, and reflectivity. The data can tell the New Horizons team how to position the spacecraft and calibrate its camera when it actually visits next year. Most crucially, the light dip might reveal spaceship-killing debris nearby. But catching the star as it dims isn't easy. The shadow passes over Patagonia at 60,000 miles per hour, and the team already failed in their two previous attempts to see this shadow, called an occultation. This was our last chance, Stern says. Their agony paid off. 5 of the 24 telescopes saw the star blink as a speck of a world passed in front, revealing details otherwise impossible to know in advance. Now, far beyond the 8 planets and 1 billion miles beyond Pluto, the most distant object ever explored, this little prince of a planet is ready for its close-up. The tiny reddish world dubbed 2014 MU-69 stretches just a 12 miles or so, a red potato about the size of Manhattan. On December 31, 2018, an army of astronomers will turn their gaze here for a few hours as NASA's New Horizons spacecraft blazes by at some 8 miles per second. It's been in a deep freeze at 400 degrees below zero all that time, so it's a perfectly preserved relic from the birth of our home solar system, Stern says of the 4-billion-year-old object. No one's ever been to any kind of target like this. A century ago, our solar system seemed split into two tidy groups, the terrestrial inner planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, and the giant gaseous outer worlds. Then Clyde Tombaugh found Pluto in 1930. It was small and seemingly alone at the ragged edge of the solar system. Scientists are suspicious of such oddballs, and some soon predicted it was part of a new third planetary realm. But Tombaugh searched for years and never found another Pluto. Hard evidence arrived half a century later, when scientists discovered Pluto's large moon, Charon. They soon realized that the pair formed when two dwarf planets collided in the outer solar system. The odds of that happening are slight, unless Pluto was part of a third group. In 1991, Stern did the math. If only two Pluto-like worlds ever existed, the chances they'd collide are less than 1 in 1,000,000. The odds get even greater when you add in other observed coincidences in the neighborhood. It would be like plunging your hand into 100,000 tons of beach sand and snagging the only purple grain, Stern wrote in Astronomy magazine at the time. Pluto and Charon make sense only if hundreds or thousands of dwarf planets once roamed the outer solar system. By 1992, astronomers had the tools to prove their hunches correct. A telescope in Hawaii, equipped with a state-of-the-art digital camera, found a 100-mile-wide world they dubbed 1992 QB1, or Smiley. Scientists have since turned up more than 1,000 objects in this region, now called the Kuiper Belt, a disc-shaped realm of icy objects out past Neptune. Its most famous member is Pluto, but another is about to take the spotlight. Astronomers suspect 2014 MU-69, or just MU-69, pronounced MU for short, is a cold, classical Kuiper Belt object. This group of worlds has stayed in flat, circular orbits right where they were formed, unperturbed by the goings-on closer to the Sun. Even asteroids, which are also excellent time capsules, were stirred up by Jupiter's gravity and bombarded by solar radiation, altering their surfaces. That doesn't happen in the cold classical Kuiper Belt. No major planets are anywhere close, and our sun's pale light, which shines like a dim star at that distance, has barely changed the surface of these far-flung worlds. They are truly primordial remnants from the solar nebula, a cloud of gas and dust that birthed the sun and planets. Mu could have existed before there were dinosaurs or trees, possibly even before the formation of Earth. We're going to fly past the oldest thing in the solar system we possibly can, says Planetary Science Institute astronomer Susan Bonecchi. And that's exciting, because it will provide information we couldn't glean otherwise. Astronomers think Mu is part of this cold classical population because of its location in the solar system, and because its reddish hue matches the Hubble Space Telescope's catalog of thousands of other such objects. The world is redder than even Pluto, whose appearance surprised astronomers so much that some called it the other red planet. That red surface comes from carbon-based materials Carl Sagan called tholins, which absorb blue light. When you see something red in the outer solar system, generally that's an indication the object is covered in complex organic molecules, says Northern Arizona University astronomer Stephen Tegler. His astrophysical ice laboratory simulated Pluto's icy surface to help astronomers understand what they were looking at. Sarah Horst, a planetary scientist at Johns Hopkins University, has simulated Pluto's atmosphere. Grab a handful of Pluto's tholins, and you'd likely find they're a kind of sticky powder, she says. Horst has discovered they're also highly electrostatically charged. They cling to the inside of vials when poked with a finger. If Mu's surface truly hasn't seen many impacts, that would leave our sun's radiation as the main force shaping and coloring its surface. Those conditions are prime for creating tholins. Horst says it's possible this bombardment has left Mu covered in a global layer of the material. But I don't know, she adds. We're going to find out, and that's what's so exciting. Seeing Mu up close could also help astronomers answer another fundamental question. How do planets form? Astronomers knew the initial solar system was full of tiny rocks, and somehow they grew into planets, asteroids, and everything else. It's always been hard, in theory, to build from pebble-sized chunks that will naturally form out of the solar nebula up to things that are tens of miles or hundreds of miles across, says New Horizons scientist John Spencer at the Southwest Research Institute. In computer models, these objects tend to destroy each other when they collide. Astronomers are starting to suspect that the pebbles mixed with gas in the early solar system and then clumped together, growing from pebbles all the way up to objects the size of Mu. But to verify that, they need to study the distant and tiny objects more closely, which is nearly impossible from Earth, as the New Horizons team showed when they tried to learn their target size and shape. We're very anxious to see what these things look like up close, says Spencer. Easier said than done, of course. Even finding Mu in the first place took a Herculean effort. Mark Bowie of the Southwest Research Institute spent nearly a decade searching for a second destination for New Horizons after Pluto, starting 2 years before the spacecraft launched in 2006. NASA built the probe to be light and fast. It covered 30 times the Earth-Sun distance, 30 astronomical units, to reach Pluto in just about 9 years. That meant minimal fuel, too, so Bowie knew any detours after Pluto had to be very close to the path the spacecraft was already traveling. To make the effort even tougher, the search area happened to overlap with the star-rich Milky Way, a region of the night sky bursting with tiny pinpoints of light. Finally, the year before the Pluto flyby, Bowie's team struck gold. Mu popped up with just enough time to verify its position and aim New Horizons in its direction. To be able to just go and find a chunk of rock floating out in space 43 astronomical units away and know that in just a few years' time you're going to be flying by it, that's why I got into space exploration, Bowie says. Once he'd found Mu, it was up to Bowie and others to calculate its orbit and predict where its shadow would fall on Earth during the occultation last summer, resulting in those windswept telescopes on Patagonia's beaches. Luckily, the astronomers saw no potential hazards near the world. "Everything about this is do-it-yourself spaceflight," says Stern. "Nobody's planning to do anything like this again. I'm sure someday somebody will go farther. But this is probably going to hold the record for decades, a century. Who knows?" 20 Things You Didn't Know About Bears. 1. With territories stretching from Arctic ice to south of the equator, the 8 members of Ursidae include the planet's largest land predators and a seriously sketchy family tree. 2. For decades, researchers have struggled to chart the evolution of bears. A genomic analysis published in Scientific Reports in April explained why. Gene flow between different species is common and can result in fertile hybrids. 3. You may have heard about pizzlies and growlers, the offspring of grizzlies and polar bears. But other species, such as the sun bear and Asiatic black bear, also hybridize in the wild. 4. Bears' backstory may seem muddled because they are the most recent carnivore lineage to evolve, splitting off from canids only 20 to 25 million years ago. 5. The subfamily Ursinae, which includes 6 of the 8 living bear species today, is even younger, evolving a mere 2 to 5 million years ago. The non-ursine bears, the giant panda and spectacled bear, split off the line earlier. 6. The spectacled bear, Trimarctos ornatus, has a habit of going its own way. It's the only southern hemisphere bear, calling the Andes home and occupying a range of habitats, including elevations more than 15,000 feet above sea level. 7. T. ornatus, which can weigh up to 385 pounds, is the last living short-faced bear, a lineage that includes the largest bear species known, the extinct Arctotherium augustindens. 8. A. augustindens called South America home about a million years ago and weighed an estimated 1,500 pounds. That's almost twice the body mass of the average polar bear. 9. Both A. augustindens and today's polar bears are carnivores, but most other bears are omnivores. The exception is the giant panda, which sticks to bamboo 99% of the time. 10. And Winnie the Pooh aside, honey is not the primary food source for any bear. Even the sun bear and sloth bear, both sometimes called honey bears, feed mostly not on the sweet stuff, but on insects, including bees, and fruit. 11. Let's put another bear-faced lie, or at least a common myth, to rest. Bears don't hibernate. At least, they're not true hibernators, like ground squirrels, which lower their metabolic rate by more than 90% in winter months. 12. Instead, northern latitude bears enter periods of dormancy, reducing their metabolic rate up to 50% and lowering both heart rate and body temperatures. 13. The animals are still easily roused, however, and typically are awake about 15 minutes a day during this period. But unlike a human on bed rest for, say, 6 months, bears in dormancy don't experience severe muscle atrophy. 14. That's likely thanks to their body's unique ability to reabsorb the waste product urea and recycle it into protein that preserves lean body mass. 15. Ursidae, excluding the giant panda, are also the only mammals with significant amounts of ursodeoxycholic acid, UDCA, which is produced in the liver and stored in the gallbladder. In concentrated form, UDCA can be used to treat gallstones and some chronic liver diseases. 16. Although researchers have been synthesizing UDCA since 1955, bear bile and gallbladders remain a popular traditional medicine ingredient in East Asia. A 2014 Interpol assessment estimated farms, both legal and illegal, held 13,000 bears in inhumane conditions for bile harvesting. 17. Wild bears are hunted for their gallbladders, as well as other parts. Species targeted include the polar bear, already under threat due to climate change. Shrinking sea ice will make it harder for the animals to hunt seals, their main food source. 18. Climate change is affecting brown bears, too. A PNAS study in July documented a shift in an entire food web on Alaska's Kodiak Island. Local bears switched from eating salmon to elderberries when the warmer temps caused the fruits to ripen prematurely. 19. The bears had previously gobbled up to 75% of the salmon population each year. Researchers believe the change will have broad consequences, including increased salmon numbers disrupting the marine food chain. 20. Through climate change, habit loss, poaching, and other pressures, 6 of the 8 living bear species are listed as vulnerable. And a future without them would be, well, unbearable. That wraps up this episode of Discover Extra Edition. I hope you've enjoyed it and will tune in to another podcast soon. Until then, expand your mind. I'm Steve Lord, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. If you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138.